Okay, so if let's start here for a minute. Is this too loud, or is it okay? Okay. Okay, so here's what's discussed in the Birch paper, that the upper mantle is different from the lower mantle because there seems to be more heterogeneity in the upper mantle than in the lower mantle. So this was borne out by what Adam was showing. Of course, he didn't have a very good picture of what was just above the core, so that's probably what's new since then. And okay, so we have two kinds of crust up at the top. Now, while we're at it, this is one thing that we want to keep in mind is how big things are. And I like to think in terms of these units of 10 to the 25 grams, which the Earth weighs 600 in these units, the core is 200, the lower mantle's 300, the upper mantle's 100, that's above 670. Continental crust is 2, and the oceanic crust is about 1. So this gives you the proportions of things, because when we do the mass balance, we're going to want to come back to this and see, well, if you've got one of the things we know something about, we think, is the continental crust, and it's got a chemical and isotopic composition that's a lot different than the average Earth. So we expect to see stuff in the mantle that's complementary to it, and we'll be talking about that issue. It gets a little bit fuzzier if you add in the oceanic lithosphere, which is, you know, maybe 10 times the volume of the oceanic crust. Then you've got 10 units of oceanic lithosphere, and maybe you've got 5 units of continental lithosphere. So the oceanic lithosphere, we can make some guesses as to what its composition is, because we think we understand what goes on at mid-ocean ridges where it's formed. But continents are formed in very complicated ways, and exactly what's in the continental lithosphere is a little bit less clear.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
If the Earth's surface is more than 2/3 ocean, and the density of oceanic crust is more than the density of the crust, why is the density proportional?
Why is the mass of the continents larger? Yeah, because it's a lot thicker. Yeah. I mean, these are very rough numbers, obviously. barely one significant digit, but the average thickness of the continents is 40 kilometers. The ocean maybe 7. So the density is not that much different, actually. Okay, so of course the modern picture of the mantle is dynamic, and we've got things going up and down and moving around, being stirred. Okay, so one thing that we're going to, that's actually going to be a large proportion of what we talk about, has to do with this, that basically everything that forms at or near the surface of the Earth gets re-injected into the deep mantle, even the water that's in the oceans. And there's even questions as to whether the ocean volume is increasing with time or decreasing with time. Because if you try to do the mass balance of how much water is coming out of volcanoes versus how much is being subducted in hydroxyl-bearing minerals in the subduction zones, it's a difficult balance to do, but it's allowable that the oceans are disappearing at a fairly rapid rate, or that they're growing at a slight rate. So when we think about it in terms of the, let's say, the mean age of the oceanic lithosphere, this is about 100 times shorter than the age of the Earth. So that we're pumping that stuff through that system very rapidly. It's going through, it's spending a little time as oceanic crust, and then it's going back down again. Okay, so this is a very important concept, that stuff that's up at the surface goes back down. So a lot of what we're doing with geochemistry is trying to figure out what exactly happens to it after it goes back down. The crust is important because it's old, the continental crust. Okay, so the average age of the continental crust is only about half the age of the Earth. So a lot of material, so there's a lot of long-term storage of chemically and isotopically odd material in the crust, in the continental crust. Maybe also in the lithosphere underneath the continents, and this is an issue. The lithosphere has a couple of different definitions. There's the thermal definition and the mechanical definition. They're similar, though. The lithosphere basically is dominated by thermal conduction, and is not generally involved in the convective circulation of the mantle. Okay, so that's what's semi-permanently stuck to the crust. That's above it. Somebody got a better definition of that?
And does that coincide with the seismic definition?
Sometimes. This is a good question. I mean, Tom Jordan made part of his career arguing that underneath continents there are mantle roots that extend from anywhere from 100 to several 300 kilometers or 400 kilometers into the mantle, and that this stuff is stuck to the continent and not being involved in the convection in the upper mantle.
But I would disagree with this, because you've shown that part of the signal is actually an anisotropic signal in the atmosphere. So you can reconcile definitions of the continental lithosphere as not being thicker than about 200 to 250 kilometers.
But that's still pretty thick.
It's still pretty thick, but it's consistent with other geophysical definitions, like geothermal kind of analysis and the kimberlites that come up from.
Well, I mean, that changes the number from 300 to 200. I like 100 even more. But it's still if the crust is on the average 40 kilometers thick, we think there's material stuck to the bottom of it, stuck to the bottom of continents, that's at least 100 kilometers thick. And that's sort of the thickness of the thermal lithosphere for old oceanic crust, right? I mean, it gets to be about 100 kilometers thick. Yes, I guess. You know.
And also chemically distinct, right? I mean, that's important. If it's thermal, as in the ocean, then it will be involved at some level because of the depth of the convective system. And part of Jordan's story is that it's actually a different composition. So it's, it's cold, but it's also light. And so it survives for a long period of time. So figuring that out is very important, actually, to figure out the cycle and behavior.
Yes, when it comes down to the mass balance business, then you might need to know that stuff. One of the odd aspects of continental lithosphere, though, is that according to the seismology, it's depleted. And this is a definition now that we have to go through a couple of times. If you melt the mantle and make magma take it out, the main elements it loses is calcium and aluminum, because calcium aluminum concentrations in basalts are much higher than they are in the mantle. You take the calcium aluminum out, and then when you recast that into a new mineralogy, you lose garnet and clinopyroxene, the two minerals that contain calcium. Okay. And so you become more olivine rich and more orthopyroxene rich, and you have a lower density. Okay. So, but the thing is that if you look at, in terms of trace elements, the continental lithosphere, we think of it in terms of being enriched. That often, if you look at the kimberlites, the volcanic rocks that come up in continental areas in the early stages of continental rifting, they tend to look like they're on the spectrum we would call enriched. And so we typically, I don't know what Stan thinks about this, but typically think about continental lithosphere as being mineralogically depleted, in other words, low in calcium and aluminum, but then somehow re-injected with all the trace element goodies. And this makes it very difficult to deal with, because we have no idea really of what the balance is between these things. Okay. Was there something else? We'll come back to this. But I mean, the question of the age of heterogeneities is another issue that we have to think about a bit. Because when you store material up here in the continental crust or in the lithosphere beneath the lithospheric mantle beneath it, it ages. It's sitting there aging. And in terms of radioactive isotopes, it's accumulating radiogenic isotopes. And so it can be sitting at the surface and be 3 billion years old, and then you can subduct it or stick it down in the mantle yesterday. So it has two ages. It has the age at which it was injected, the time at which it was injected into the mantle, And it's isotopic age that sort of reflects how long it was aged up in the continents or up in the crust. And so when we talk about, when we look at the isotopes in oceanic basalts and we talk about the age of the heterogeneities, we have to be thinking about what, you know, this may not be the time it was injected into the mantle. This may have something to do with how long it was stored up at the surface first. Okay, now this is an important concept that I think that I'm coming to this conclusion that we in mantle geochemistry, we tend to have, because we're looking at lavas, we can only see the mantle where there's melting going on. So it turns out that if you think about the mantle, probably we're introducing heterogeneities from the top, which would be the subduction and processes that happen at mid-ocean ridges and so on. And we can also introduce heterogeneities if, for instance, there's a dense layer down here or we've got stuff coming off the core mantle boundary. So we're introducing heterogeneities at the top and the bottom, but we also probably only can sample the top and the bottom. If you look at melting in island arcs at mid-ocean ridges and continental rift zones, it's basically just sampling what happens to be underneath where the processes are, where the volcanism is, the upper 100 or 150 kilometers. And if we look at mantle plumes, they may be sampling only the very bottom. And we'll go through this in a bit more detail in a minute, but if you look at typical mantle plumes, the only thing that melts is the very hottest stuff from the bottom of the boundary layer, which, if it comes up under the lithosphere, is the only thing that's ever going to melt. And you're never going to see any lava that's represents any of the entrained material that it might have passed through on the way up. So we may be getting a very biased view of the mantle because we're only looking at the top and the bottom. Okay, now, what we're going to try to do with mantle geochemistry is, again, infer something about the past history of material that's circulating around in the mantle and coming up into areas where it can melt. And so there are certain elements of this system that we think of as being important. They're where chemistry happens. So at subduction zones, things are happening. At where plumes are, well, actually, probably the biggest issue here is what happens at mid-ocean ridges. So we know that at mid-ocean ridges, material comes up, it melts. You generate a new kind of material with the crust and its underlying mantle that didn't exist before that. That stuff actually undergoes further chemistry as it sits on the ocean floor and heads toward a subduction zone. When it goes down a subduction zone, things happen to it. If it gets down to the 670-kilometer discontinuity, there's some issue whether, you know, does it all go down there, or how much of it goes down there, or is there separation between the deeper part of the oceanic lithosphere and the shallow part of it? And then there's things happening at the core mantle boundary. So we think we know enough about the processes happening at various places here that we know what the fingerprints in terms of chemistry and isotopes are of these processes, so that when we see something coming up and melting under a mid-ocean ridge, we can say, okay, there's a little bit of recycled oceanic crust there, because we know that recycled oceanic crust should look like this. There are different views as to what happens when things go back down into the mantle, and I recognize that the little lines on this diagram are not dynamically consistent necessarily, but give you some idea of, in my view, and I think at least there's a subset of people that view it this way, that if you put things down into the mantle, they never go away. They just get skinny and difficult to sample. So as they get stretched and stirred, the one length scale, the thickness as they get stretched out, that continues to decrease. But they don't ever go away because chemical diffusion in the mantle is very inefficient. And you can see that if you look at rocks as well as lavas and global distributions of isotope ratios, that there are heterogeneities on all scales from centimeters up to thousands of kilometers. The problem is that there's potentially large amplitudes of these heterogeneities in terms of isotope ratios and trace element compositions, even at very short length scales. we talk.
You can sample the material from a core mantle boundary, right? By this plume closure?
Yeah.
And where are those plumes you see?
Where are the plumes?
From the core mantle boundary, like Hawaii?
Hawaii. Iceland.
Oh, you think it's from core mantle boundary?
Yeah, well, this is another issue, isn't it? Well, but, you know, that's fine. If you don't want to have it from there, then what you need is, if you don't want it to come from the core mantle boundary, you have to figure out what it is it comes from. Because in order for it to melt under the lithosphere, the Pacific lithosphere, it has to have a very high potential temperature. This is something we can get into a little bit. I'll mention it if I have time. When am I supposed to be finishing, by the way? Okay. Okay, here's one of the problems, and one of the fantastic things about geochemistry is that there are all these parameters that we can measure. And the problem is, and I must admit to it myself, that, you know, when I think I sort of understand some patterns in the data for five isotopes, somebody comes in with a sixth one and says, well, you know, it doesn't fit the sixth one. And the question is, and now there are so many numbers out there that it's difficult to really be up to date on all of the things that people have been finding with all the various parameters that can be measured. So this is a list of some of the radiogenic isotopes that we work with quite a lot. And in addition to those, there are stable isotopes, oxygen isotopes, boron, lithium, hydrogen isotopes, other noble gases like neon and xenon, sulfur, and potentially you can get some information about things that are going on in the mantle from all of these radiogenic isotopes, plus the isotopes of some of these other elements. In addition, there's the concentration ratios of some of these elements that are also used. Okay. Now, in an earlier slide, I showed that the crust of the continental crust and the oceanic crust are very small in comparison to the mantle. So why do they matter? The reason they matter is that their chemistry is immensely different from the mantle. So this is a diagram of the concentration of different elements in continental crust is in yellow here. This comes from Al Hoffman. And then there are some representative basaltic lavas from different places, and also a typical mid-ocean ridge basalt is shown here in blue, and a typical Hawaiian basalt in green, and then some of these other basalts from Tristan and Tubuai. Okay, so if, in particular, if you look at these elements in this range here, you can see that they have concentrations that are on the order of 50 to 100 times higher than the average primitive mantle that's been deduced by working forward from chondritic meteorites. And if you consider the fact that, in fact, because these materials have been taken out of the mantle sometime in the past, what's left in the mantle is even more different, so that depleted mantle tends to have a pattern. This is not done meant to be accurate or precise here, but roughly you can get factors of 2 to 10 or 20 depletions in the mantle due to the fact that this material is being stored up in the continents and in the continental crust and in the oceanic crust. So the difference in concentration can be on the order of 100. So even though it's 100 times smaller in terms of mass, because it has 100 times more material in it, it can have roughly half of the budget for the whole Earth. And this has a number of ramifications, because if you subduct this material and stick it back down in the mantle, you may have very thin bits that are stuck down there. But because they have such huge concentrations of some of these elements, they're real poison for the mantle, and they poison a much larger volume than you would expect.
Is there no more controversy about printed mantle?
There isn't much controversy that makes much difference. How would you answer that?
The first order, I think, we understand the trace element composition of the mantle. There are the isotopes that we all worry about.
Yeah, for the ones that are, and we'll cover this a little bit in one of the lectures, that are refractory lithophile elements. So these are things that during the condensation sequence of the solar nebula, they condensed early. So there wasn't much question. And they weren't volatilized when the Earth was accreting. Those things were pretty good with. But things like lead and cesium, which can be volatile, they're a problem because what's in the Earth is a lot different from what's in meteorites, and we have to sort of make a number of arguments to guess what they are precisely. There's a few things that come up. For instance, with lutetium hafnium system right now, there's some question both about the exactly what the chondritic lutetium to hafnium ratio is and exactly what the half-life of lutetium-176 is. So that one is a bit that's a little murky. And with samarium neodymium, I don't think there's much of an argument about what the chondritic value is or what the half-life is. And strontium, we could talk about a little bit more. Strontium's a little weird. But probably for the same reason that lead's a little weird, is that rubidium is a volatile element, and so we're never quite sure what exactly the Earth started out with. Oh yeah, I said this was not accurate. It is, but you know, it's enriched by so small an amount that you can barely detect it. Because again, if you take out a fraction of a percent of a material and it has no magnesium in it, then you've only enriched the mantle by a fraction of a percent. Typically we measure magnesium concentrations to a percent, and you wouldn't notice it.
So is there a price definition of what volatile
means?
You eat it, it goes away.
There's probably a more precise definition than I can give you, and the people who work on meteorites that could give it to you. These are elements that don't condense at high temperature from the solar nebula, so that when you look at the high temperature condensates from the solar nebula, they tend to have virtually none of these elements in it. They're very highly depleted. Yeah. But then there's another component of it, which is the accretion history of the Earth. Vicky?
I was just about to ask how constrained are the temperatures of the accretion?
I don't think they're that well constrained, but it depends what you mean by well constrained, I guess. The models that were originally generated by Grossman and Larimer 30 years ago haven't changed a whole lot. I think some of the data in terms of making predictions as to what should be volatile and not may have changed a bit. And the temperatures go from sort of 2000 C down to a few hundred degrees C. You know, it's a fairly complicated business. But now that people have looked in more detail at meteorites, they see that there's a lot of reprocessing of some of this stuff, and there are some complications. But it's still the case that things like lead, which just from its chemical properties, you can tell you can evaporate it at a low temperature, whereas something like a rare earth element, you can't. Okay. and rubidium and some of the other things, cesium. We see it in terms of mass spectrometry. If you put cesium on a filament in vacuum at 600 or 700 degrees centigrade, it evaporates off the filament. If you put lead on the filament, it'll do the same thing. It'll evaporate rapidly at low temperature. If you put a rare earth or rare earth oxide on, it doesn't evaporate. You have to take a temperature up to 1200 to 1400 degrees C. And some other things like osmium will never evaporate. It's after the core formed, and it's, well. Wait, ask that again.
I was saying on the right-hand side of the diagram where all the curves for the crust and MORV fall below the line one for the primitive mantle, the normalized concentration, it also includes aluminum and silicon. So I was wondering, is it because we lost some to the moon? Or
oh, you're looking at this diagram that I'm showing you here? Okay. Yeah, silicon, it's pretty close to one. I mean, the average crustal rock has 50-something percent silica in it, and the average mantle rock has 40-something. So it's only enriched in the crust by about 20%, and if you figure that the crust is only a fraction of a percent of the mantle, it really has very little effect on the mantle. And again, the same thing is true for magnesium. I mean, if you just do the mass balance with the continents in the oceanic crust, that they don't have very much effect on what's left in the mantle. Okay.
I was under the impression that EM1 and IMU represented different mantle reservoirs. Those two lines look pretty similar to me. Are those enough different to say those are two different?
Yeah, well, they're different on the isotope plots more than on this. They're more obviously different. I'll get to that in a sec. Okay. Now, another issue. I like to think about it in these terms, and it's probably wrong because I'm probably not up to date on this. If you think about what happens to heterogeneities when you put them in the mantle, we know, for instance, that the oceanic crust, the basaltic part of the oceanic crust, is maybe 5 or 6 or 7 kilometers thick. So you're introducing a heterogeneity at that scale all the time as subduction is going on. And then let's say it were 10 kilometers thick, and the question is, well, how thick would it be after it spent 1 billion years in the mantle or 2 billion years in the mantle? And some models show these thicknesses going down very rapidly, and others, if there's more, the shear is more laminar, they could last for long periods of time. Okay. If you think of the whole oceanic lithosphere, it's more like 100 kilometers thick. So whatever it is that you're putting in here, whatever the scale is, it's going to evolve with time. But the point is that you're always putting in new heterogeneities at those scales. The other way to look at it is, what do we actually see in the rocks? And if you look at mid-ocean ridge basalts, and I think we have an exercise on this, and I have one figure, you see variability at mid-ocean ridges that go from tens of kilometers up to thousands of kilometers. Okay, so we see those big, large-scale variability. If you look at lava sequences, like in flood basalt provinces, if you just go through the section and look at how the isotope ratios vary and sort of recast those into thicknesses of heterogeneities in the mantle, you can see variations that go from hundreds of kilometers down to maybe a kilometer or something like that. And if you look at ultramafic rocks, which are mantle rocks that are exposed at the surface, you can see heterogeneities that go down to the centimeter scale. So you can see all of these things, and the question is, it would be nice if you could date heterogeneities by their size. In other words, if you were typically putting things in that were 10 kilometers in thickness or 100 kilometers in thickness, and they decreased in thickness exponentially with time, then you knew that if you were seeing something that was 1 kilometer, it was probably was a billion years old. But I think that's too simplistic, probably, of a way to look at it. These are just kind of random points about heterogeneities that I'm bringing up here that we can think about. The other one that I wanted to restate was one that I already mentioned, that if you put something that has a crustal-like, continental crustal-like composition into the mantle, even if it's a thin stripe, it has a particular isotopic composition, and the element that has that isotopic composition has a very high concentration as compared to the background average mantle. Okay. So that thing, even though it has a physical thickness, which I call lambda H, if you calculate the amount of background mantle material that you have to mix with it in order to bring the average isotopic composition back down to something close to the average for the mantle, it basically goes like the ratio of the concentrations. So that if you have 100 times higher concentration in here and the layer is a kilometer thick, you have to average it with 100 kilometers of depleted mantle in order to come back to something that's half, that's in the middle between the two isotopic compositions. So this little piece of stuff in here, if it's say half a kilometer thick, may never show up on anything that you can ever see with seismology or any kind of geophysics, but it's causing an effect in the mantle there that has an effective scale that's much larger than it because of the concentration. This is something that's not normally taken into account when people think about mixing and stirring in the mantle. Okay, let's look at one example of making heterogeneity, which we can talk about in more detail. This is a busy diagram that comes from an ASIMO and Langmuir paper that was published in Nature, I think, last year. And the point of this diagram is to show that if you change the amount of water that's in the mantle or the potential temperature of the mantle, that you get different thicknesses of oceanic crust because you start melting at different depths, you generate more melt. So this is increasing potential temperature. So if you have cool mantle, if it's coming up at 1300 degrees C, doesn't start melting until relatively shallow depth. If you have hotter mantle, 1450, it starts melting at a greater depth. And so you generate more liquid as you come up and you get a thicker crust. And if you add water, that also changes the picture because you start melting incipiently at a greater depth if you just add water. So from the low water, low temperature range to the high temperature, high water content range, you get a range in predicted crustal thickness. But what he's trying to show here is actually adding the water starts the melting at a greater depth, but you don't actually get all that much more crust. So this goes from 2.8 to 3.7, this goes from 10.3 to 10.9. So that was the point. But let's just take one of these pictures and follow through for one isotope system what you get out of that. So let's call this the mid-ocean ridge factory. So you bring rock material from the mantle up passively toward the surface, then turns to the side as the plate spreads. It starts melting down here if it has water in it, and between here and here it only melts a little bit because of the way that water affects melting. And then it starts melting more seriously when it gets up into the main melting region here, which is where it would have melted if it was dry. Okay. So when you look at what you have for a section, a vertical section out here after you've gone through this factory, you've got basalt gabbro crust, you've got very depleted rock beneath it. In other words, it doesn't have much calcium aluminum in it, so it has very little clinopyroxene in it, so it's a Hartzbergite. That's olivine and orthopyroxene. And below that, you've got rock material that still has some clinopyroxene in it, but it's it's lost quite a bit of calcium and aluminum. And then down here you've got this incipiently melted stuff that's, it's only melted a less than a percent or a couple of percent. Actually, I should mention that Vicki Lee, who's here, has been working with me. We're trying to follow through on what the ramifications of this lower stuff is. Okay, as it goes through the hot region in the mid-ocean ridge, that gets hydrothermally altered up at the top, so there's some exchange with the ocean, so there's some modification up there. And then as it ages, as it sits on the ocean floor, it gets some sediment dumped on the top of it. So now we've got this section that has all these different kinds of rocks in it, and we can make some predictions from the melting models as to what the trace element compositions are going to be for these things, and also then how the isotopes are going to evolve with time later on. So if we continue this and just look at neodymium isotopes, and again, you can remember that we've got a whole slew of them we could look at. So this is a scale of the epsilon ND value, where 0 would be the chondritic value today, and plus 10 is about where typical mid-ocean ridges are today. And so if we looked at the profile for neodymium epsilon just a little bit after the oceanic crust form, the sediment might have some negative value of about minus 10. The basalt would have close to the value that it started out with, about plus 10. The Hartzbergite and the strongly depleted larsolite would have high SMND ratios, so they would start to get evolve higher epsilon values. And then down here, we've only changed things a little bit. They would have lower values similar to what you started with. And down here, the unmodified mantle material would have about the same isotopic composition as the basalt, and they would be the value that they, pretty much the value that they started with. If you wait a billion years, so you put this stuff back in the mantle, and even though it might shrink in the vertical direction due to stretching and so on, you still maintain this structure, what you get is the sediment moving even farther off to the left because it's depleted in samarium relative to neodymium. The basalt doesn't change very much because it doesn't have a different samarium to neodymium ratio. These depleted parts go far off to the right, and then this stuff just changes a little bit down here, and then there's no change in this, or very little change in this down here. So what you end up with is a package of rocks up here near the top, which is very heterogeneous. It has a huge range of isotopic values and in a fairly short vertical distance. And then a big package of stuff down here that has more modest differences that are, and it's a larger length scale. So here's an example of how you produce heterogeneity, and then what you do with this later on depends on what you're going to see in the mantle. Now the next step in getting the stuff down into the mantle is to go through a subduction zone, presumably. And this, there's a lot of argument as to what goes on here. There's quite a bit of processing that goes on as this section of lithosphere heads back down into the mantle. We know that material is transferred from the descending slab into the overlying wedge. Some of the overlying wedge is coupled to the lithosphere plate and goes down with it. Some of it produces magma and some of the material comes out the top. So one of the big complications in geochemistry is what exactly happens in subduction zones, and there's been quite a bit of progress. This figure comes from a talk that Terry Plank gave last year at the Marconi workshop, and she focused on uranium and lead and was able to make some arguments that they have made some progress in understanding how those work. Now, if you think about all the things that can happen and all the things that can go down subduction zones, it's not clear that isotopic compositions or anything else are going to be very systematically distributed in the mantle. But one of the things that Stan Hart discovered is that there are some systematics to this, that you can classify things, and in certain areas of the Earth, there's a predominance of particular kinds of heterogeneities that you can label and categorize. If you just look at neodymium isotopes and strontium isotopes, this diagram shows a couple of different things that are worth mentioning. One is that the isotopes in all the mid-ocean ridge basalt rocks are fairly tightly clustered here into an array on this diagram, which is fairly steep. And if you look at sediments that are laying around out there, they have a much larger range of isotopic compositions. And if we think about more generally about where things are on this diagram, this is where we think the bulk Earth is. Now, the bulk Earth is determined for neodymium because we know what chondrites are. For strontium, chondrites are not a good representation of the Earth because of the rubidium problem. And so we've established the bulk Earth value for strontium just by extrapolating this cigar back down to where it crosses zero. Okay, so there's a little bit of uncertainty as to where that is. In general, young continental crust has higher epsilon values and older continental crust has lower. And then there's some stratification in the crust too, that the lower continental crust is rubidium poor, so it tends to be this way. The upper continental crust is over here. And in general, crustal rocks can form, fit anywhere in this box, and you get values all over the place. So even though, and then if you think about where residual mantle could be, it also could be anywhere out in this area in a much bigger volume. So one of the important observations is that even though there's a huge variability in the amount, in the compositions of things that could go down subduction zones and be reinjected into the mantle, the mid-ocean ridges, even and with the ocean islands, actually look fairly systematic. They're not quite all over the map. They're in a more restricted version region of this diagram. And they're almost all on the plus side of zero here for neodymium. So they're all in the direction we would expect them to be in if they're complementary to the continental crust. And the average continental crust plots somewhere down in this area. So just to illustrate this other thing about the mass balance, if you look at chondritic meteorites, again, I'm not sure that I have this precisely in the right place. It is vertically, but I'm not sure exactly what the range is here. If you look at chondritic meteorites and measure their strontium isotope ratios, they have very high numbers in comparison to basalts from the Earth. And this is proof that the Earth has lost rubidium in the process of forming relative to these chondritic meteorites. But it makes it more difficult to establish what the bulk Earth value is with precision. Whereas in the vertical direction, we think we know the neodymium isotope ratio very well because both samarium and neodymium are highly refractory and the ratio of the two in the Earth should be pretty much exactly the same as it is in chondritic meteorites. And the ratio in chondritic meteorites doesn't vary by more than about plus or minus 1% or something like that if you take reasonably large samples.
So how critical is the assumption that deer studied identically as a compound and how fair?
It comes into play in estimating, for instance, how much of the mantle mid-ocean ridge basalts represent. Actually, I've got another slide to illustrate that. This is one of the critical things. I mean, if you look at, let me address it one slide or two here. Maybe it's okay. So to follow this through one more step, if you look at some of the isotope ratios for both mid-ocean ridge basalts and ocean island basalts, this is this point that's basically that Stan Hart discovered. That if you look at certain rocks and classify them on one diagram because they plot like the red ones here, which is the high mu, they plot in a particular part of this diagram. If you look at some other isotopes, they also plot in a particular part of that diagram. So there's something systematic about the way that neodymium, strontium, and lead, and also a couple of other isotopes, are behaving that you can identify that in a certain region. A couple of volcanic provinces, that you're sampling a mantle that has a particular kind of history, and it's consistent for strontium, neodymium, and lead. And again, if you go to this EM2, they cluster here, and then they also cluster on this diagram. So there's something systematic. Now, Stan will talk more about this, and And maybe when he's done, I'll understand more about the full ramifications of this observation. But the point is that they're not entirely random, that there's some systematics to this stuff, and the full implications of these we can discuss of this observation. Okay, so we've talked in general about fingerprinting different processes. Al Hoffman gave a talk at the Marconi Center last year and gave a list of what kinds of things you might expect to see down there on the mantle and what would be their fingerprint. And he also put, this is not a completely consistent list because he's got different types of information over here on this part of the list, but in some places he thinks he can see that kind of stuff. Depleted oceanic crust, he can see maybe in Iceland or Hawaii. Lithospheric mantle, this is what it should look like. Some things like hydrothermally altered oceanic crust, he doesn't think you see. Okay, now this is a little bit odd, but maybe it's because it gets modified in subduction zones, and that's why you don't see it. And he also puts down here the subduction flux, but again, this is a little bit misleading because lithospheric mantle, for instance, for isotopes like neodymium and hafnium, doesn't have very high concentrations of these elements. It has a big flux, but it has a low concentration. You put in terrigenous sediment and other types of continental material, has a much lower flux, but it might have 50 times higher concentration, so it may have just as much effect on the isotopic composition of the mantle. Okay, so material balance, and I'll speed up here, and if you tell me that I should stop, I can just go to the end. So if you look at the neodymium scale and blow it up so that we can just look at the distribution of mid-ocean ridge basalts, the bulk earth should be zero. Okay. Now if you take all of what we can identify in continents and its neodymium isotope composition, which plots down here maybe at minus 20, and calculate what the average mantle should be so that if you added the mantle back with the continents, you'd come to zero, it would be somewhere around here. Okay. So what you see with mid-ocean ridges is that the average value for the mid-ocean ridge basalts, which is up here somewhere around 8 or 10, is not the same number as the average mantle if it's compensated. The compensating reservoir is the continental crust. So it's this basic observation which has led people to say, well, the upper part of the mantle can't be representative of the entire mantle, and therefore there must be some gross layering. The upper part of the mantle is more depleted than the average mantle. So you can't change this argument by saying we don't know where zero is. That's probably what you can change the argument by saying that the continental crust is not the only thing that's over here. That in fact there's some other thing either at the base of the mantle, the continental lithosphere, that you haven't added in properly, and that you might be able to push this average mantle further this way, which would make it maybe a little easier to make mid-ocean ridges more similar to the entire mantle. And then again with regard to heterogeneity, and I think we have a tutorial planned that where you can try to get some of these data off the databases and do this kind of thing for yourself. This is just all the neodymium data from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge as a function of latitude, but not beyond about 50 degrees north. And what you can see here is that there are some large-scale changes, that there's a big range. This is where we think the average depleted mantle plots. This is where the average mantle would be. This would be primitive mantle or the bulk earth here. So most of the data plot up here pretty far away from the average mantle. But what you can see is that there's variability on short length scales that's quite large and also on longer scales. This is the kind of thing that is at the scale where you might be able to compare it with seismological data. The helium, I'll just mention quickly, one of the issues with the other isotopes, neodymium, lead, strontium, hafnium, is that if you take depleted mantle represented by mid-ocean ridge basalts and mix it back with continental crust, you can get back to something that is close to the primitive earth or the primitive mantle. So In the beginning, some of us argued that there was primitive mantle, and then people said, well, no, it's not primitive mantle, it's just a mixture of the stuff that's enriched and depleted, that's just been mixed back together, and there's really nothing that's primitive. And if you think about the Earth and how much processing you're doing of oceanic lithosphere, the simplest way to deal with it would be to say, well, there's unlikely to be anything that's unprocessed, and therefore, you know, let's think about the Earth not in terms of primitive and depleted, but basically just, you know, different remixtures of enriched and depleted material. Helium is a problem in this regard because if you take mid-ocean ridges and add it back with the continental crust, you get numbers between 8 and 0. And then we have these plumes that come up like Hawaii that are numbers way off to the right here that are in the 30s. And you can't get those by mixing mid-ocean ridge basalts back with the continents. So helium is a particularly thorny thing. It's almost requiring that you have some kind of primitive material down there that's not been processed and doesn't fit this idea that things are going in and out of the mantle all the time, so everything's been processed in the past. So, I mean, Stan will probably mention that there are ways that you could explain the helium by having it be processed, but still most, it's not easy. Okay. So one last thing is, I wanted, well, actually, a couple of things I wanted to mention with regard to sampling. There's two examples here. One is, and they're both sort of referred to Hawaii. If you look at the Hawaiian plume, this is a sort of simplified map of where the magma is coming from. So this would be magma generation rates in the plume. Basically, you're generating magma in a circular region that's about 100 kilometers across. And when we have drilled through the lavas on Mauna Kea and looked at the stratigraphy, which is kind of a transect through this red region here, from the edge of the melting region into the closer to the center of the melting region, we see some changes in the helium isotopes that go from the mid-ocean ridge values to high values, some systematic changes in the neodymium. But the problem here is that if you look at what this represents in terms of the whole plume, shown here, the extent of the melting region shown by the solid black line here, so this is, if you think of it as being sort of Gaussian shape, this is the 2 sigma edge of it. The plume is actually spreading underneath the lithosphere, so where it's melting is actually wider. If you take that, trace that material back down into the mantle, it's even a narrower cylinder. So the material that melts in the plume might have this kind of diameter down at 200 kilometers depth, and the thermal anomaly is this big. These are the geodynamic, based on the geodynamic models. So the only thing that ever melts is this little bit in the middle. And all of this material out here, which is thermally anomalous and probably came from the boundary layer, never melts. You never see it. What? What is a model? It's based on a geodynamic model, which is trying to match the amount of melting that you have to get, as well as the geoid and bathymetric anomalies. But the model's been done 2 or 3 times, and they get about the same answer. Okay. So I mean, this. What are you worried about, the size here? I mean, the one sigma sort of width is, you know, about 100 kilometers. It's just that if you go all the way back to the sort of background temperature, it gets to be closer to 200 kilometers wide, the plume. Okay, so if you sort of map the helium isotope anomalies onto this picture, you get these very high helium isotope ratios only in this narrow region here, which is much smaller than the overall thermal anomaly. So if you're looking at, you know, how you might map that into what's coming up the plume, what you're seeing is only the very base of the mantle. So there's stuff in the core of the plume is coming from the very bottom of the mantle, and you're not seeing any of the entrained material that comes from higher up in the lower mantle, and you're seeing nothing that comes from the upper mantle. So another way to look at this is that if you picture the plume as being something like this, what you're seeing with the helium anomaly in it is basically just this stuff right down at the very base. I mean, you could think of it in terms of the dense layer instead of the core mantle boundary, but it's still what's ever been entrained at the very bottom of the mantle reservoir. And it turns out that the strontium behaves differently than the helium. The strontium anomaly doesn't seem to be so concentrated in the middle, it's broader, and the helium anomaly is very narrow. So you can get some additional information by looking in more detail at individual plumes or any other melting anomalies as to how the heterogeneities are distributed. But this is a very important point, I think, that in plumes, we're not seeing, quote, the lower mantle. We may just be seeing the very bottom of the mantle. Okay, so we've been trying to do this in a more sophisticated way. Matthew Jell was working on this, and I've been talking to him recently. He might do a little bit more work on it if he has any spare time. If you think about what happens with the material coming up and then being dragged off by the lithospheric plate, the geometry of the melting and its relationship to the structure in the plume is fairly complicated. This is illustrated by these diagrams here. This is the melting rate that Matthew got in his model. So it's not a bullseye like I showed, but it's a little bit distorted. But this is sort of a relationship between what's melting and what used to be in the core of the plume as it was coming up from greater depth. So it's a complicated relationship between where the melting occurs and where the material that used to be in the core of the plume ends up as it starts being turned over by the overriding lithosphere. So one other issue, one other way to look at this is if you've got material melting in the mantle, over what distance are you averaging the isotopic ratios? And I wrote a paper on this once, and nobody's ever done this again, so I don't know whether even what I did is correct. Nobody's really ever checked it very well. But the point is, if you've got material coming into a melting region and it's got an isotope ratio varying with depth or height along some function, question is, what do you see coming out the top of the system where you have melting going on, percolation of melt, and then collection of that melt, storage in a magma chamber, and what comes out the top? And one way to think about this is that the way you attenuate these heterogeneities in the magma production system is by the heterogeneous flow, so that the dispersion, due to the physical dispersion of the flow as the magma percolates up through the melting column, is what averages the isotope ratios. So I took some of these profiles through the Hawaii Drill Corps, modeled them, and tried to estimate the dispersivity in the melt zone under Hawaii. And the number came out something like a kilometer, hundreds of meters to a kilometer, which means basically that you would tend to average, if you had a very systematic one-dimensional system, heterogeneities that were shorter than a kilometer would tend to get averaged away. But you would still preserve things that were a kilometer and larger. Now, it turns out that this kind of dispersivity is exactly what you get from a groundwater system if you sample it at a distance, tracer at a distance of 20 or 40 kilometers from the source, which is about the thickness of the melt zone. So the question of how big is the sampling area is one, I think, that can be treated much more quantitatively than anybody's done yet. I gave it a shot here a few years ago, but I think we could do a much better job on this. And one point to bring up is that in recent papers by Mark Spiegelman and Kellerman and others, they've been talking about this channeling instability that can happen for mid-ocean ridges. If you have very heterogeneous, these are supposed to be channels where there's high permeability, so melt's moving through them very rapidly. So it's like fractures, but they're not fractures, they're just high permeability zones. If you have this variability in the permeability, that corresponds to a very large dispersion. And so what you're doing in this case is you are doing very large amount of averaging in the vertical direction. Now with Mark sitting in my office and us bullshitting about this, we decided that even though this applies to mid-ocean ridges, it's likely that the parameter range for plumes, like in Hawaii, it's not going to happen. So it is possible that mid-ocean ridges have this instability and do a much better job of vertical averaging than plumes do. So that we might have to take that into account. Exactly how much vertical averaging this does is unclear, because unless Mark's doing the problem now, nobody's done it yet. Let's try to put in a certain amount of heterogeneity down here and see what you get out at the top if you put it through this system. Okay, I think I'm going to just stop here because I'm going on too long, but you can look at this stuff later. So in the next couple of weeks, we've got the lecture set up so that we're basically going to go back over a number of these issues. Initial conditions, how you deal with isotopes and the radioactive decay, the partitioning and so on, melting and melt migration, so and some of the modeling for large-scale systems, both box models and the melting problem. And these are the things that we've been thinking about with regard to tutorials. And if there's anything that I've said here or that comes up in the next couple of lectures that doesn't you don't see on this list but you're interested in doing in a bit more detail, it's worth bringing it up to us so that we can think about whether we can put together some kind of tutorial toward the end that would address things that you might be interested in that we haven't anticipated that you'd be interested in. Okay, I'll stop. Sorry.